young lad who went at pick five. He's headed for the Gold Coast. Mac Andrew creates a bit of history himself with a tremendous heritage as he comes to our game. Mac, congratulations. It's great to have you on SEM.
Oh, cheers. Thank you. Cheers for having me.
How big was last night for you?
Yeah, well, it's crazy. Crazy experience. It's been a long time coming. And, you know, to get to experience it with, you know, my friends and family, yeah, it was just great.
Was it almost overwhelming?
Yeah, it was like, I don't really know how to feel. Like, it was just, it went pretty quick. Like, felt like it went for ages, but quick at the same time. I just, like, don't really know how to describe it.
And the family, you're surrounded by your loved ones for it. Is what was their sense of what you're about to embark upon?
Yeah, they were all really excited for me. They're probably keen for me to leave the house. You know, got a big family, so they're probably keen to get me out the house. But they were really excited for me, though.
Yeah, there was great excitement all around. So could we tap a little bit of your footy journey? Actually, maybe the family journey first. Mac, you referenced last night that your parents had sacrificed a lot. So born in Egypt, you come to Australia of South Sudanese heritage. What do you know about your parents' decision to come to this country?
I just know, you know, they fled South Sudan to go to Egypt. And then, one of my dad's brothers gave them a form to fill out to come to Australia, and you know, Dad just filled it out, hoping he'd be able to get accepted in. And then he did, and I guess that's just kind of how we got here. And then came across 2004, and so all I remember is pretty much just growing up here, starting school here, starting footy here, and all that.
It's a big family story, isn't it? When you think about the world and what they would have lived through.
Yeah, it's crazy to think about all the stuff that they had to go through just to get me here. Really grateful for all that.
Whereabouts did you grow up in Melbourne, Mac?
Started off down in Winterna South and then moved out to Berwick around 2015. That's where I've been ever since.
And when does footy enter your journey? Did you start playing as a little kid?
Yeah, I was pretty early, under nines. Down in Winterna South as well, the local club there.
At what age does it start to get serious for you?
Probably just going into last year, was like my first year playing, at a NAB club and like the under 18 system. And then I thought if I had a good year last year, I could set myself up for a really big year this year. And then obviously last year got scrubbed out. So I just try to have a really strong pre-season this year and then just try to put my best foot forward for this season.
If we'd said to you 12 months ago, hey, Mac, you'll go in the top five in the draft, would you have believed that?
No, probably would have laughed at you. Probably thought you're crazy.
How rapidly has it all unfolded for you?
Yeah, it's all been really quick. Like, everything just happens, you know, like in the blink of an eye. It happens, all really quick.
How much footy did you get to play this year, Mac?
I think I would have played maybe five NAB games, and then I think two or three school games, and then got to play the academy game as well. So maybe 10 or so altogether, if that.
Did you miss it when you weren't able to play it?
Yeah, it was pretty annoying, like not knowing, you know, when you might have your like last training session or last game. So, yeah, it was pretty annoying, but couldn't really do much about it. I guess after the first lockdown, you kind of knew what to expect when you go into it again.
Yeah. When did you start to have conversations with clubs?
This year, I think my first one would have been before the season, and it probably started to ramp up midway through the year, like during COVID. They were doing a lot then. So probably, midway through the year is when I started getting quite a few.
And what sort of impression did you get? Did you start to realise at that stage that this was not only a real hope, but that this was going to happen for you?
Got to the point where I was, I put myself in a good position. I was pretty confident that I was going to get drafted. It did give me that belief and confidence that I'd be a chance.
And Gold Coast, so how intense has that been in recent weeks?
Yeah, so I've talked to them a couple of times, I think three or four times maybe in the past couple of weeks, and then had a meeting with Stewie Jew and like the coaching staff on Monday, and then me and Cal have been having just regular phone calls as well.
Did it start to build an excitement in you?
Yeah, kind of. I think I kind of knew for a while that it was like a real possibility. I was really, really excited for it to actually happen.
There'll be a lot of players who are facing up to the reality, as you say, of leaving home and leaving the state. Are you ready and eager to get on a plane and abandon Victoria and set up home on the Gold Coast?
Yeah, I was probably one of the boys who weren't as nervous to like moving to state. So I'm pretty keen to go up to the Gold Coast as well. You know, good weather up there, and they got really good young talent. And you know, it's a club that seems like they're heading in the right direction.
There'll be an impatience to play. There always is, Mac. What will your short term be? Will you set yourself to play early in your first season, or what's your development path, do you think?
I'll probably just try getting cracked down and intersect my teammates, and then hopefully set myself up to try play early as possible.
With your background, Mac, do you feel like you're representing the community as well? So the first player of South Sudanese background to go in the top five, and Alia is there last night, and the players that we've seen across the competition over the past decade or so. Are you sort of leading the community a little bit, do you think?
I feel like I am now. You know, you get messages from, I guess, like younger Sudanese kids, congratulating you and like, telling you about your journey as well. I do start to feel that now as well.
The reality is today you're an AFL player. It's pretty great, isn't it?
Yeah, it was pretty good waking up today, stress-free and all that. It was really good.
Mac, enjoy it. When will you leave? How quickly do you have to be on the Gold Coast?
I think I have to wait for the border restrictions, so not for a while. I think I've got a couple of weeks still here.
Little bit of time at home to get life organised. Mac, congratulations. It was great to see last night for you and for the other 19 players. It's a brilliant night to see careers get underway. Good luck.
Cheers. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Mac Andrew, who went pick five, he heads to the Gold Coast. 1-300-736-736. Share your first impressions. Draft night last night, the players who were instantly taken, and I reckon they touched our hearts a little bit last night. It's such a reassuring event for footy. I know it's a bit long-winded and all, but it does give us a chance to meet all of them and just to get that first snapshot of their story. I don't know whether there have been more important Boxing Day tests and Australian Opens for this town, given the reawakening we are about to go through or have embarked upon. The director of the Australian Open is Craig Tiley. He's done a power of work in the past month or so to land the tournament. Craig, it's great to have you on the program.
Thanks, Jared. It's good to be talking again, especially this time of the year.
Yes, it is. Your tickets are on sale. Do you get an instant indication when the possibility for the public to snap up tickets happens?
Yeah, no, we do. We went to public sale at noon on Friday, and instantly there was a rush to get tickets, and which is fantastic. And then, of course, the 6 weeks leading into that, we'd been in pre-sale. And our pre-sale numbers each week, we were breaking the record of 2020. So that was great news. And we've had a really strong beginning of public sale. We do think it's going to be continue to remain strong throughout. And we think there'll be a big push again at the end when people have confidence about going back to events, knowing that they're safe.
So it is a bit of a social study on that front, isn't it, Craig? We'll live through that with the Ashes and then through the Australian Openers. We have full crowds, which is fantastic. And what is the willingness of people and the eagerness of sports fans?
I think that's exactly right. And we're all going to find out a lot. But our first indication has been that fans, they want to check and make sure that if there's any COVID-related actions that are taken, that they have the insurance on the refunds of their ticket, which we have 100% of the Australian Open, and then also wanting to just have a look and see what everyone else is doing. So we believe it's going to be a slow movement, but this is what we believe. Before we went to public sale, the public sale for us has been really strong. So maybe that trend will change. But I don't think it's one of those immediate situations where you suddenly come right back to your record levels immediately. I think it's going to be, this is our prediction, it'll be a slower process. But with that being said, you know, we're really enjoying a strong uptake. Early.
Was it the source of some comfort that right on the cusp of going to the public sale, that's all restrictions on crowd levels were lifted?
No, absolutely. And we always knew that when we got to a high vaccination rate in our community, that there will be restrictions that be lifted across the community. And that has happened. And at the event, the event will be one of the safest places to be, because we'll still be practicing safe distancing and the right hygiene protocols, and everyone on site will be vaccinated. So going to events now in Victoria, arguably amongst the safest places to be, but certainly having the restrictions at the point where we can be at capacity and have a COVID safe plan that works for everyone, and where people just feel like it's almost returned to normal. And I think that's going to be a special experience for everyone. We've got some fantastic initiatives planned for our fans and as well as for the players. So we're looking forward to getting going.
You navigated extreme complexity to stage the tournament earlier this year. What's the passage of the past 6 months been for you, Craig? Have you had any days where you thought, I don't know how we land it again?
It's a great question. I think actually this event has been a lot harder to plan for than last year. Last year, pretty much the whole world was locked down. So any opportunity to put on an event and have professional players travel from around the world, we were the first to do it globally. And I think it was a successful event in 21. Obviously, we had very few fans compared to other years. And that was because of the lockdowns. Then we thought, okay, we're through this now, then we'll be out of the pandemic, get on the other side, and it'll be a lot easier. But we learned very quickly that was not going to be the case. A lot more variables for this event. Vaccinations is one, border closures, border entries, you know, getting into the country, coming from, again, countries that have now high infection rates and low vaccination rates, and how we manage that, testing regimes. So it's a lot more complex, a lot more variables than we've had before, and a lot more uncertainty, and a lot later, because it's only now that we've got the conditions. So we've got to turn this around really quickly. But that's the environment we're in, and everyone's going to have to learn to be a lot more agile and flexible and adjust a lot quicker. And I think that this is not just going to be for 22, but we're fully expecting it to go into 23 and beyond. But finding a way to create a COVID normal environment. But no, it has been a lot harder. No one in the company has really taken a break since November 2019. So we've decided to give everyone a massive break in April next year and make sure everyone's doing the same thing.
Was there ever a contingency, Craig, which either didn't have the tournament in Melbourne or didn't even have the tournament in Australia?
There have been moments where there's been uncertainty as to whether that was going to be realistic. But we just really, as an organization, as a team, have hung in there. I mean, I'm mostly proud of the fact that we've kept the organization whole right throughout this. And hopefully we come out of it in the same position. We certainly plan to do that. And for everyone to really just take a breather, reflect a little bit on what they've achieved as a company and as a group of people, because it's been absolutely remarkable. And the one thing I have to say is that we wouldn't be where we are today and in Melbourne if we hadn't had the unwavering support of the Andrews government, because I think they've wanted nothing more than to have the event as a stake in the ground and as a milestone point to show the world that we're open and show the world that we've actually really managed this well. So that's going to be an opportunity, I think, for the cricket and for tennis.
So the tension around the vaccination piece, which played out across a pretty intense week in Melbourne, how critical was it that the tournament reflected the values of this community, which cherishes this event so much?
Well, I think absolutely. I mean, that was table stakes for us. That's a position that we've always held. There was a lot written and said about, you know, Tennis Australia's attempt to have the vaccination requirements changed. And none of that was true. We've always said from the beginning that we'll follow the direction of the we support, most importantly, we support and follow the direction of health and the chief health officer as well as the government. And we've never not done that. Certainly there are some players. It was interesting, 6 weeks ago, only 50% of the global playing group, because each of them are independent contractors. They don't have a union that dictates what they can do. They make their own decisions. But 50% were vaccinated 6 weeks ago. Today, more than 85% on. And we take a lot of credit for that because we put a vaccination requirement on it. We think by the time we get to January, it'll be between 95 and 100% vaccinated, because if you're not, you cannot play. There are one or two players that obviously have medical conditions, as there are in the community. There's a medical condition exemption, but it's a very high bar to get across. But it's everything's exactly in line with what the health mandates are, and so it should be, because there shouldn't be any preferential treatment for anyone coming into the state compared to what the regular community is going through.
So, how much swings, Craig, on whether Novak Djokovic is here or not?
It's a great question, and I wish it's one I could answer. I have spoken to him and his team, and interestingly, he's shared his status. He's really just asked the question. He's made a statement, two things. One is that he believes that what you say around your medical conditions and status is private to you, and he also believes that people should have the right to choose. That's his choice. We've made it very clear, coming to play the Australian Open, the requirement is to be vaccinated. And if you're vaccinated, and that's against the approved vaccines as well. And if you're vaccinated, you play. And if you're not, you're unable to play the Australian Open. And that's the condition for 2022. And so everyone's aware of that. We'd love, Novak's won 9 Australian Opens. I'm sure he wants to get to 10. He's on 20 Grand Slam titles, as is Rafa Nadal, who is coming, and Roger Federer. And so one of them is going to surpass the other, and I don't think Novak could want to leave that beat to someone else. So it's still a question that needs to be answered, but we'll see. Everyone understands the conditions of entry.
Are you at all concerned what the public reaction to Djokovic might be, or if he comes and he's vaccinated, that hopefully that soothes what you well know has been a really hot topic?
It has been a hot topic, and I've answered more questions on that than I think anything else. But I think we've got our public's the best sporting public. There's no question in the world, because we go to sporting events. We appreciate greatness. I mean, he's one of the greatest players of all time, and I think our public appreciates that. I mean, he's had a view on something which some share, the majority don't. And I think there'll be fair treatment of Novak. And one thing for sure, if Novak's here in January, we'll know that he's vaccinated. So regardless of someone's position, all the players will need to be and show proof of vaccination even to come into Victoria. So we've got the majority of the players in that position, and that has been a journey in itself as well, because it's not a requirement anywhere else in the world. But it does also indicate the importance of the players wanting to come to Melbourne.
Craig, we played unsuccessfully a little bit of listening comprehension with Nick Kyrgios. Whatever did Nick mean with his comments around cancelling the Australian Open? Have you spoken to him about it?
Yeah, I don't think... He certainly didn't mean... his communication to us, it didn't mean that the Australian Open should be cancelled, because this is the place that he has the most supportive crowd anywhere in the world, and people know when you go and watch Nick Kyrgios, you're going to be entertained, and he knows that. So I think that there was a little some context confusion in it, and as you know well, Nick wears his heart on his sleeve. He says things that are on his mind, and that's what creates so much intrigue with him. And he's a great tennis player, and we know when he's on fire, he can beat anyone in the world. And we hope he gets to January, and every single day he's on fire and ready to compete and do well, because the Australian public would really enjoy that. But one thing you get assured with Nick, it's always going to be a hot topic, and it's always going to be of interest.
You've got two huge local draw cards separate to that. Ash Barty, who's the reigning Wimbledon champion and the world number one, and Dylan Alcott, who's playing his final professional tournament. It gives you two superb showcases as you do your planning, doesn't it?
It does. Unfortunately, Dylan's going to make this his last event, and I've tried to persuade him to continue, but that's not been successful. But it'll be fantastic. What we're planning on doing is in these matches, we want to break the world record for the most number of people watching wheelchair tennis. And so we're going to showcase it. We're going to highlight it, put it in prime time and enable anyone to get a chance to see it. So that we're excited about that. And then when it comes to Ash, of course, I mean, what a great year she's had. She's one of the few players for the third straight year will end the year ranked number one in the world, and she's coming in as a last year semi-finalist, and we would like nothing more for her to be into the finals. We've moved the women's semi-finals to Thursday night, the second week, as a prime time show, and then we'll play the two men's semi-finals on the Friday. So we'd love to see Ash on Thursday night, and again on Saturday night in the finals. And we do, the men as well, together on the women's side, on the men, we've got some great young players, and it's an exciting time for Australian tennis at the same time as we're enjoying the boom years like the 80s as far as participation rates. I mean, we've got more than 35% up in participation across the country. So we're very pleased about that too. So a lot of things are going really well for the sport, and we'd like nothing more than to showcase, some great tennis to the fans and to come out and enjoy our beach house, enjoy the world's best chefs. We're launching now, with now the conditions of crowds, we're launching now a music program, which we'll be announcing again soon. So it's going to be a fantastic summer.
I asked this question just with an ounce of trepidation. Can anything trip you up from here, Craig, or do you feel like you are through it and clear to plan as you need to?
I don't want to answer that question.
Yes, fair enough.
But anything can happen. We've learned that. I think we're more prepared for things than we have been before. I'm incredibly proud of our community, Melbourne, and the people at Tennis Australia that have been through a real tough time on being able to pull this off. And we will pull it off, and we'll make everyone proud. And I think when we get to the end of January, hopefully in the Boxing Day test and in the tennis, we can look back and say, like, we actually are back. We've found a way to manage the virus. To beating it's going to be very difficult, but to manage it, we're keeping everyone safe. We're doing the right thing, and we showcased a global event. The Australian Open gets beamed into every single country in the world, and we'll be excited to be able to showcase that and have a lot of narrative around what a great city Melbourne is and a great country we live in. And I think January is going to be a chance for us to brag about that.
We look forward to it, Craig. It's a critical part of our reawakening. So see you in January, and the very best of luck with the planning.
Look forward to it. Thanks, Jared. Thanks as always, and look forward to seeing you soon.
Craig Tiley, the tournament director of the Australian Open. I want to set you up with a bit of summer reading. I've been collecting books over the past few weeks or so. How might you find your relaxation over the summer? I'll be at cricket grounds and on planes will be a nice novelty. I've got a few to take with me. The first is Adam Zwaar's 12 Summers. Being a lifelong fan of Australian cricket is harder than it looks. It's a quite brilliant memoir. It stitches in the cricket events of, so Adam and I are a similar age, of our childhoods, as well as Adam's life story as well. It's given me a great laugh reading it over the past few nights going to bed. Adam, it's always great to have you on the program.
Good to talk to you, Jared. We started out together, didn't we?
We did. So you're born in 72, I'm 74, so we've lived the same cricket events at almost the same age, and we were together there at the Sunday Herald Sun. So there's a few characters in here that absolutely appealed to me as well.
I'm looking forward to those phone calls from the Sunday Herald Sun, our friends at the Sunday Herald Sun. But yeah, it's very much a fan's point of view, this book, speaking about cricket from an emotional perspective, probably a lopsided emotional perspective in many cases, as opposed to, being a pundit. And I think it's very much in the tradition of Fever Pitch and books like that.
But you are dangerously close to becoming a touchstone as having made the Underarm documentary, the Bodyline documentary, and now written this book. You're getting pretty close to expert territory, Adam. You've got to be a bit careful.
That's right. I can hold a conversation with those cricket experts, you know, to a point, and then they just go over the edge a little bit. But I do love it, and it's an overriding passion. It's something great that, like, I was a bit of an anxious kid, and cricket was my solace. That was the thing that, you know, I was an only child, and we lived in a remote location, so I didn't have many friends. So, you know, I think I say in the book, you know, the cricket commentators were like kind of surrogate fathers, and the players were like brothers to me, and I knew everything about them. I knew their nicknames, their star signs. I read all the players' profiles in the Australian cricket magazines, and I knew what their favourite meals were and whether or not they smoked. That was a big thing for me. I one of my favourite things was the question with Richard Hadley was like, last book read, and he said, I only read books that I've written. and so, you know, I really kind of immersed myself in that world, and it's kind of just stayed with me. It's been a solace throughout, you know, the last 40 years.
So the Underarm is such a big part of our lives, of every cricket fan's life, if you're of a certain age. So I was there with Dad and Grandpa that day, and you're watching on telly from Queensland, and it is so vivid. Last year, on Fox Cricket, when they started to clip up the minis of those games, it was on, and I was mesmerised by it, and I could, it transported me back there at the time with the disputed catch and the sense of tumult that engulfed the end. So it was a big thing for a kid to deal with, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I mean, there's a great sketch. There's a Mitchell and Webb sketch where they're both dressed as Nazis, and Mitchell says to Webb, "Are we the baddies?" You know, in the sense that, and it was like, so you got Greg Chappell not walking when Bracewell clearly caught him out. I think it was deep mid on, and then the umpire said they didn't see the catch, so they couldn't give him out. And then you've got in the last over, I think Hadley getting out LBW when the ball clearly pitched outside leg, and then you've got the Underarm. It was just like, oh my God, how much can these New Zealanders take? And the more research I did on it, it was like that Muldoon, the New Zealand Prime Minister, was on a plane at the time, going from one city to, I think it was Wellington to Christchurch. And the pilot was giving updates over the intercom on the plane. And, you know, he'd say every ball he was giving an update. And then there was a long pause, like minutes went by, and Muldoon's kind of going, what's happened? And then the pilot comes over the intercom and said, they've just pulled Underarm and now everyone's arguing. And then kind of the flight kind of erupts in like discussion and disgust. But it really defined it. And, you know, the Prime Minister was upset about it. My parents were upset about it. Everyone was talking about it at the school the next day. So yeah, it was such a defining moment. And I would add that Matthew Hardy, the Melbourne comedian who has been on SEN, his dad left with two overs. His dad was at the ground with Matthew and his brother, and they left the ground early because Matthew's dad wanted to beat the traffic.
Classic. Classic. Our car had been broken into that day. It's how clearly I can pin it. So there were a spate of car radio robberies in the car park at the MCG. Dad drove a blue Fairlane, and the car had been broken into. So I've sort of got, I can remember the unease as we all left, and then that when we got to the car.
Oh my God! And you were in Geelong at the time, were you? You had to go all the way back.
No, we were Mulgrave at the time. So So it's funny how that goes. The other summer it resonates so strongly now, and Dean Jones is obviously stitched into it, particularly after his untimely passing. So Australia versus Australia A is such a big part of the life of a cricket fan.
Yes. And were you at the age, were you on Australia A's side? Were you barracked for Australia A?
So I had the Australia shirt, but I do remember it being a dreadfully conflicting time.
Yeah, so did I. It was so conflicting. And I think I even say in the book that I didn't know who I was anymore. It was like, you know, it's like, can you be in love with two people? I don't think you can. It's a really difficult thing. But I think when the McGrath-Hayden collision happened, inverted commas collision happened on the pitch, I leapt out of my seat and I was very angry with McGrath, even though McGrath hadn't done anything. And, you know, replays showed that it was just, there were just two players just slightly bumping into each other. But I was outraged by that. I was outraged by Mark Taylor being upset with the Adelaide crowd for being on Australia A side.
Yep.
But then I was outraged myself for being outraged. You know, it was literally, I didn't know who I was anymore, you know. Particularly when you got the war, you know, Warne and the Wars and Taylor, and I loved all those guys. What was I doing barracking against them?
There's some great tales in here. I loved reading about your dad and the anecdotes that he could tell and his prowess as a shooter. So no spoilers. I'm going to just leave that story untold. It's very good. And as to how we are now, Adam, so you, in the last pages in the epilogue, you sort of address where we are as Australian cricket fans now. And this week in particular is challenging in the aftermath. How do you describe yourself, the following of Australian cricket and your connection to it now as it was compared to when you were a kid?
I'd like to be a little bit more mature about it. I'd like to think I was a little bit more mature about it than I was, you know. I mean, especially at the age, I end the book apart from the epilogue, I do end the book in 2007 when they're all still my kind of age. But after that, I started to get older than them. And so I felt a little bit a little bit silly to be hero worshipping people who are younger than
yes.
me. So I kind of grew up in that sense. But I find that, you know, as much as everything in society, everything is a little bit kind of disconnected. And, you know, you've got so many formats of the game. You're not following those same 11 players around. So that was a little bit like a soap opera. You know, those 11 guys that you watched play over, you know, the course of a decade, you'd probably have, say, and it'd be about 20, almost 25, maybe, that you'd be following. So you knew everything about them. Whereas now you're following about 45 or 50 over the course of a decade. So it's a little bit kind of disparate. But I was really connected by the T20 World Cup. And I heard your text messages before, and it was great seeing Mitch Marsh. And, you know, I love a great redemption story. And I'm a big fan of Adam Zampa. And there used to be a time, Jerry, when, you know, I hate to admit this because it's kind of egocentric, but occasionally I would type my name into Google and I wrote Adam and then Zed, and it would come up Zwa. The predictive text would come up Zwa. Now it comes up Zampa. So,
very nice. Hey, last one, Adam, as we finish. How would you describe your interactions with Alan Border throughout the years?
Not great, even though he's my ultimate hero.
Yes.
I think I've just freaked him out a little bit by being such a fan. You know, when I first met him when I was a kid, I knew everything about him. And I went up to get his autograph with Dad, and I said, do you miss working in the BHP film archive department as a clerk? Do you prefer Bic or Pugsley or AB? Is your favourite drink still Tia Maria milk? Except I pronounce it Tia Maria milk. And I wrote, oh, how Dad and Mr. Border laughed. And then Border told me I was a good kid. And, of course, after that I was, you know, I was a big fan. And then he came through a play that I'd written called The Inner Sanctum, which was based in the Australian cricket team dressing room. And he really loved it. But then I think I just took the conversation a little too far. I knew where he lived and everything. And he got freaked out by me. He thought I was a stalker.
So, it translates, you know, beautifully, Adam. Yeah, they're great stories. You told them well and transported me back to times in my life, and it will do for many people who read it. So we're indebted to you as ever for your cricket material. It's brilliant.
Thanks, Jared. I really appreciate it.
Good on you. Adam Zwa, who's written 12 Summers, being a lifelong fan of Australian cricket is harder than it looks. I would highly recommend that to you on your summer reading list.